I'm with David McGee, and we're talking about humour in marketing and communications. You're going to hear a little bit about David and his eclectic background in just a moment. It should be quite an interesting conversation, this one, because, you know, I think as we've sort of been discussing before we pressed record, a little while ago, and we were talking about whether it's a thing, whether we should, whether we could. And I really want to explore with David, who has given quite a bit of thought on this subject, really the concept or the question which I have, because a lot of the textbooks traditionally have said keep humor out of it because it's too subjective. It's yes, it might have a few little upsides, but it's too high risk. Now, I want to challenge that in this conversation, because I don't actually fully believe that. I think if you really know your audience, there is a place for it. But I really want to hear what David thinks on this one, because he's given this a lot more thought than I have. So we're going to go there and have a little bit of a conversation around that. But for those of the people listening here, David, who don't know you, could you give a little bit of a backstory? Who is David McGee?
Yeah. Well, I am a lecturer at a university in England, in the UK, Birmingham City University, have been for 5.5 years now. Prior to that, I had an eclectic background. I was primarily in media and communication, working backwards from my time at BCU, Birmingham City University. I went back to university, did an MBA at the rival university across town, University of Birmingham. Came out of my MBA, had an idea for a startup, got very much involved in the entrepreneurial scene in Birmingham, quite active entrepreneurial scene. We ran out of cash. We developed some really interesting technology, but we ran out of cash in the field of antique counterfeiting technology. Going back further into my history, prior to my MBA, I worked out in Afghanistan with the with NATO, working in what's rather spookily called PSYOPs, but fundamentally it's about influence. It's about trying to communicate to people, please don't do this, or please encourage people to or the population or the target audience to do something. Primarily in Afghanistan, kinetic environment, please stop shooting at us. Was the principal message. So not very effective, to be perfectly frank with you. Did that for 4 years in Afghanistan, loved it, worked a lot with the Americans, got a huge amount of American friends, especially in Los Angeles, on both coasts, actually. Great, great fun. And the Americans were putting a lot of resources into that. Prior to that, I was working, prior to Afghanistan, I worked in the field of journalism for BBC as a TV reporter, and then prior to that worked on Fleet Street, the hub of British national newspapers, for about 8-9 years or so, and prior to that did a bit of travelling, did my MBA, my undergrad. So in a nutshell, communication, moving out of journalism into the influencer space, psychological operations for the military, and then came out of that, did went back to academia, which is where I ended up, where I hit you now. So coming back, if it might be useful to talk about, why am I talking about humor? I'm not a comedian. I can't tell a joke for love nor money. My timing is terrible. However, I agree with Neil that there's a lot of mileage, which I think is currently not treading on the use of humour. And I think maybe it's an opportunity to kind of give you, where did I get this idea from? I'm doing a PhD on the use of humour in communication effects. So can we, use humour to better improve the effectiveness of our communication? That's a question. That's the purpose of my PhD. Open mind. I believe, my thesis is, this way, I believe so. So I'm testing a thesis in my PhD which says that humour could be used. And I'm going to go through a variety. Maybe we'll talk about how I'm doing it later on. So I'm going to try and test the effects of humour on a particular data set. And I believe humour is an affective, it's an emotional effect. If you laugh, we all laugh, we generally feel positive about something, we feel emotionally attached, we feel engaged. And I think those are the qualities which any decent marketeer would be, would pay them, give their right arm for. If you can engage, if you can cut through with an audience, I think it's very, very effective. I teach at the university, I teach marketing, and there was one statistic which came to me a few years ago that we, as modern day Homo sapiens living in the West, we get about 10,000 messages every day, hitting our eyeballs, hitting our earballs. So that could be obviously the traditional billboards, but it's people's logos. There are messages and there are logos and there's so much communication hitting our eyeballs every day. How do you, I mean, on social, and that's old data, by the way, that's about 6 years old. So you can imagine with the proliferation of social media, that's just increased. So we're getting about six, maybe possibly north of 10,000 messages. How, as marketeers, as communicators, how do we cut through? That's my question. How do we do it? Well, go back and try, as Mr. Jobs says, don't try and invent, steal. Best people, best inventors steal other ideas. And I've just gone back to basic Aristotelian principles of, if you want to communicate, you can go through the heart, you go through the brain, and it all has to be from a position of trust. Pathos, ethos, and logos. Written 2,500 years ago by Mr. Aristotle, sitting on a marble stone somewhere in Athens. That's what he came up. If you want to communicate, you've got to emote, you've got to attract the logic, and it's got to be from a position of trust, the ethos of the individual. That's why Boris Johnson, let's bring it back to the UK and contemporaneous activity. Boris Johnson today, last night, dropped out of the leadership campaign. Nobody believes a word Boris Johnson says. I've got 102 people who've signed for me to stand up against that. Nobody believes a word Boris Johnson says. He can be the most effective, most emotional, logical argument, but if you don't believe the individual, it's not going to cut through. So I took those basic Aristotelian principles and figured out how can we better cut through the miasma of messages we get every day. And I felt humour was something which I could potentially look into. And where did I get this? And another way, where did I get this idea? Well, let me tell you the backstory. I was on a plane coming in from British Airways, from Toulouse, flying to Heathrow, 2.5 hour, 3 hour flight, and sat on the plane, sat down. We've been on hundreds of planes. We all do the same thing. We sit down and we zone out. We're not interested in the safety message. We're interested in the duty free. We're interested in chatting away. We're just not interested. I don't. I mean, we just get the zone out. We've done it 100 times. This time, I looked at the safety message. And this time, for the next 4 minutes, they had my rapt attention. I was completely drawn in to this message. And if you go online, maybe it's a link which you can put on, Neil. The British Airways took a very, in my opinion, very brave decision to use humour in the safety message. I won't bore you too much about what they did, but basically they used humour. They got people to laugh while being told that their life jacket was beneath there too, where the exits were, where the lights on the road. I mean, all the usual message was told in it from a position of humour. And I went away and I thought about this, and I actually got off the plane and my friends, we went on a hiking holiday to the Pyrenees. My friends were saying, "Crikey, did you see that message?" I was listening and thinking, there's something in this. There's something definitely in this use of humour. because it cut through. Cut through with me, it cut through my friends. And I thought, hey, there's got to be something there. There's got to be something to investigate, to test, to try and see what the basis of this. And that was the basis. That moment when I walked off that plane in Heathrow, is like, there's got to be something here. There's got something where, as professional communicators and professional marketers, we should be able to use marketing humor in that process. But I just don't know how. And that's why I've been trying to investigate in my PhD. I haven't got the results yet. PhD is, we're at the stage of data collection. If anybody's done a PhD, you'll know that there's a huge ethical issue. You've got to make sure your ethics are all in all your ducks in a row. And I'm just at the close of my ethics now. So over the next 3 to 4 months, I'll be collecting my data. So maybe it's an opportunity to give you my initial analysis. I will be presenting it at a conference in Boston next year for the International Society for Humor Studies, ISHS, which I'm a member of. And it's great because talking purely selfishly, I get to read a lot of jokes. I get to read a lot of, you know, amusing stuff. It's actually really enjoyable. But I also get to understand the theory of humor as well. And I've sort of, as is my nature, distilled it down to its basic principles, which I think are consistent with every humorous position, every humorous scenario has, I say, at least two core characteristics. Happy to talk about that in a second. But every humorous joke, every humorous situation that we all go has to have two elements, the two fundamental elements. Without that, there is no humor. And
we need to get to that. Yeah. Fascinated by those two elements, because I don't know the answer here. And I'm sure everybody listening is thinking, go on, David, tell us. But we'll come on to that. Go. I just want to take a little sort of step or two or three back to your time in Afghanistan. Not necessarily to go into huge amounts of detail. I'm sure there are things there that you obviously can't talk about for sensitivity reasons, but humor in a situation or scenario like that, is there a kind of a boundary in which humor can't cross? Because obviously you were talking in a very sensitive place about hugely sensitive things. Would that be a step too far?
No, I quite the opposite. I think fundamentally, again, the fundamental, those two elements, which I'll come on to in a second, cut across all cultures. Certain cultures, you know, add on, a couple of add-ons, if you will, but fundamentally, if you engage with somebody, they generally tend to respond. And I should say that the Afghans, like saying the Afghans, like saying the Europeans, they're made up of four or five strong, dominant, strong ethnic groups: Pashtuns, the Tajiks, the Uzbeks, Hazara. I mean, it's like saying the Spanish are the same as the English, as the Irish are the same as Romanians. They've been formed by very different forces, but fundamentally, the Afghans as an entity, they've got the wonderfully playful attitude towards life. They like a laugh. They're very open-hearted people. And playfulness is one of the elements which is required, one of the fundamental, in my opinion, I should say, I'm here to be contradicted, but one of the fundamental elements of any humorous setting, any joke, has to have a degree of play instilled in instinctive in it. And I think there's an element of that in the culture. There are certain things you wouldn't talk about, but then that's more common sense rather than you know, the prohibition of humor. But then in some instances it could be talked about. So I think as long as you've got a common sense and you've got your head screwed on, a lot of communication can be used, certainly in a war zone, in a kinetic zone. I think we should be using more a degree of humor to cut through. Because one of the things which I found from the certainly listening to them, the Afghans, was they just didn't believe what we said. Full stop, end of, no chance. You know, they don't believe. They know we're trying to persuade them, they know that, and therefore they just switch off, back, not interested. It's like the instinct of a party political broadcast. Somebody's trying to flog you an idea about a party. They just turn off. I'm not interested in that sales pitch. And that's what we failed so often in Afghanistan. It's trying to persuade people. And they're going, well, what about this? What about that? What about that? And you just never cut for it. And so I think on the whole, the mission was try to apply things. I could understand why it is that the army and the military is quite rigid in its thought processes and not necessarily open to different approaches. And I don't necessarily think there was an awful lot of buy-in to those, to the use of alternative ways of developing the messaging. It sounds like a bit of a criticism. It is a criticism, I guess, of the communication process within a war zone. There are, in my opinion, better ways of doing it. But we're getting off point about humor here. We're talking about psychological operations in a war zone. There is plenty of learning which we could do if we're going to do that properly. If we're ever we're in a war zone, plenty of ways of doing this. Look, if you want to look at a good practice, just look at the Ukrainians out in Russia. They're doing it pretty well. But it's a different topic, different subject. I'm more than happy to talk about that in a separate podcast, I think.
Mm. Yeah, and it's interesting because I'm kind of trying to sort of, for myself, I guess, sort of, and on behalf of people listening and watching, trying to kind of establish where and how far we can kind of push this whole idea of humour. I mean, if you're responsible, for example, for a brand, I mean, let's bring it right back to kind of commercial level rather than necessarily looking at sort of national level in war zones, etc. At a commercial level, you know, we might have brand guidelines, for example, and the brand guidelines say kind of here's the boundary within which we're allowed to operate. So the kind of messages, the propositions, the kind of things that we'd be confident to talk about. When it comes down to something like a regulated industry, for example, so if you're in pharmaceuticals or the legal profession or telecoms, you know, really heavily regulated industries, there are kind of almost sort of compliance issues here. If you step outside, and again, this is, I mean, I'm again willing to be sort of disputed here, because if you step outside of the boundary of a safe kind of central point, and by that I mean, you know, the rules and the kind of terms of engagement, let's call them that, from a sort of a brand guideline rule book. If you step outside of that, there's risk. Instantly you've identified risk in the mix here. It's going to be a really confident or maybe foolhardy person who's going to actually take that risk, isn't it? And actually introduce this ingredient, which by its very nature, I mean, I love that first word of the two, that the playfulness, that kind of sort of, it's a little bit ambiguous. It's a little bit vague. It's dangerous ground, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree. And I'm not here to say, and if it's come across as I am, I'm not here to say that humor can be applied in every communication effect. I'm not saying that at all. What I'm trying to explore is, and I'm in the foothills of my research here, is how do we cut through on a relatively benign subject matter? It's not about funeral directors. It's not about the law. We're on a relatively benign, safe position. How can I better, is it possible to use humor? Yes, no. If I am going to use, if that answer to that is yes, if I am going to use humor, is it possible to test a humorous message against a standard message? This is actually, I'm giving you the methodology of my PhD here. Two messages, a standard message, and I've got a the same information, but in a, using a degree of humor. Okay, so standard message telling 4 or 5 point bullet points, exactly the same information but delivered with a degree of humor. How better is, or how worse, I don't know what the answer is because I haven't received any data yet, but how effective is the humorous message? Is it effective? And that's in a fairly bland statement. There's no regulatory issues about my subject matter. It's about, to give you a bit of background, it's about student engagement with universities. In short, universities pitch every year for new students. Okay, every year, about this time of the year, there are open days up and down the country, and they're pitching for students to come and visit them, and also then hopefully sign up. I've been to open university open days myself. My daughter's going to university, hopefully going to university next year. Been to quite a few open days. And there are literally dozens, if not hundreds, of these open day messages all over the internet. And they're all the same. They're all pretty standard stuff. Is it possible to see if I can put a humorous element into that? Would it be effective in the eyes of the audience? I don't know. I guess it will be. Because my hypothesis has been informed by my experience, the Toulouse Heathrow Airport, and all the reading which I've done in my literature review suggests strongly that humour has been used very effectively by the advertising industry and by the marketing industry. And I just want to know, is it possible to do that within a relatively benign setting? Now, further research may say, maybe I can try and explore the parameters within the regulated industry, the law, the drug companies and all that. Perfectly reasonable. Instinctively, Neil, it doesn't seem to fit common sense that you could use humour to sell funeral directors. Something inside of me, I've got no evidence to suggest it, but common sense would shout out to me, you can't flog a casket with a good joke. I don't know. I could be wrong. I don't know. I wish the Tory party had a bit of sense of humour. You can't honestly tell us that Liz Truss is going to be a great leader. Do you have a sense of humour? No, she's going to be a great leader. Nobody had a sense of humour about that. And I say the same thing about other industries. But what I am instinctively asking in my research is it possible to apply it within a business setting, within a communication setting? All the evidence suggests, Neil, that it is currently being used, but I'm interested in putting a more of a methodological approach, because there's actually surprisingly a lack of evidence out there saying how has humor been used within the commercial information space setting. I've plainly in my literature review over the last year, 18 months or so, I've been searching, and there's not a great deal of evidence out there to suggest that humor can be used within this setting. I'm here to be contradicted on that. And if anybody wants to contact you and tell them, what about this paper? What about that paper? I'd be delighted to. But I haven't seen much out there. So that's a perfectly good question in short. And maybe it's something which I can potentially look into after I've got finished my PhD. There will be papers in that, I guess. But I'm not sure how humor be used in a commercial setting. So that's fundamentally the nature of what I'm trying to understand.
And I guess over the years, we all kind of have grown up on, and I guess, you know, people growing up now on the marketing and PR textbooks of how you should do your, you know, your sort of due diligence in, you know, serving your customers and your audience and things. And we've kind of, I guess, grown up on what is now probably quite dated theory. I think it's interesting to hear that, you know, you've not really found a huge amount of evidence or even, you know, an appetite to study this, because to me, this would be a topic that, you know, as soon as we first had the conversation about, should we go there? Should we actually talk about this on the podcast? I was like, totally want to do this, because it feels like it's been such a long time coming. I mean, I can remember sort of way, way back. I mean, this is quite some way back where, you know, early websites would never even consider in some industries having people on the website as imagery. You know, I mean, they come back to use the legal sector as an example. I mean, law firms with websites would always have, you know, the front of their offices and the grand kind of main entrance to the building. You'd never see a lawyer on the website. Oh, no, we keep them in the back office. Whereas now, you just wouldn't not expect to see, you know, the whole kind of range of partners and senior partners and anybody who's going to be, you know, sort of representing you. You'll see their biographies, you'll see their photos. So I guess we've become much more personal, even in kind of what is termed quite a serious industry, the sort of legal industry. Is this kind of what you think probably is one of the key triggers here, is that as a sort of a humanity, it's not even just a society or communities, probably as humanity, we are really now starting to recognize that actually we're human beings communicating with human beings. I mean, H2H used to be B2B, B2C, business to business, business to consumer. It's now H2H I'm seeing all over the place, human to human. Yeah. And it feels like then this becomes more of a thing, because if you're allowed then to have a proper relationship and to properly communicate, well, as we would in kind of real life, it is then potentially playful at times. It is kind of getting to know the person. I always use the phrase professional intimacy with your best customers. I mean, that's kind of ultimately what we're after, is an intimate professional relationship. It's almost like you can't do that without humor, because you would in a natural setting anyway. So do you think it's almost that this is the time and you're kind of in that sort of perfect storm moment? Because it feels like it from where I'm looking.
Who knows? I instinctively feel I agree with everything you say. I think there's, it's not like this is not new news, guys. This is like Mr. Aristotle was talking about this 2,500 years ago. If you want to communicate with people, you've got to emote with them. You've got to get on with them. Now you can tell them a hot story. You can make them cry. You can make them laugh. I mean, I had an open day at the university. I was presenting an open day at the university on Saturday. And I've done these a few times, about half a dozen times or so. And I could do the exact same spiel, get it over and done within half an hour, and people would have forgotten about it 5 minutes later. I know how it works, but I needed to emote. I needed people to kind of, you know, break down those barriers, realize that they're being sold to. Fundamentally, let's not cut away from the fact that we're trying to communicate a message of positivism, but how are we going to do that where it's credible, where it's authentic, where it actually tells authenticity? I think it's an element of it. And I think I emoted. I told them a personal story. First 30 minute or two, I told them a personal story. The audience, the open day, both parents and students. I remember my day, my first few weeks at university, many, many moons ago. I remember that. And I remember how scared I was, how bullied I was, how nervous I was. And yet I had this front of confidence, but it was paper thin deep. I remember, so I imagine what these young 17, 18 year olds who are going to university next year, I imagine what they're going through, because I've been through it myself. So I felt it was authentic to emote that. And I try to use humour. Now, you know, the humour has to have two elements. It has to have a degree of playfulness. You know, doesn't mean you have to turn up with quite a red nose on your nose and, you know, big floppy shoes and, you know, squirt water through a flowery. You know, you're not looking talking to be a clown, but you have there has to be an expectation from the audience that there's a degree of playfulness. Now, if you think about that, if you go into a comedy club, you expect to be entertained. So there's a degree already set as you walk through the door. There's a degree of playfulness written down in the contract that you have when you walk through that door of the comedy club. But if you want to communicate on a humorous level, you have to instill in the audience their expectation. There's a degree of playfulness coming down the pipeline for them. So they need to know that. The second element, I believe, until I'm contradicted, is incongruity. There has to be something which surprises, which is not what it is expected. So playfulness and incongruity, which is pretty much consistent with the theory surrounding humor, but if you boil it down, every humorous interaction has those two expectations, incongruity and playfulness. Without those two ingredients, you don't have humor. Incongruity on its own, that seems a bit odd. It's a bit weird. Liz Truss was incongruous, bizarre, but she was actually being serious. Therefore, she was not humorous. So unless you've got two elements to play, those two ingredients, you won't have humor. I say that's part of my humor. That's part of my hypothesis, if you will, for my PhD. And it's creating that sense of play. I personally think it's more difficult to create the sense of playfulness to a complete stranger. You know, if I meet you in a shopping line or an open day, you're going to be a bit nervous. You're going to be, how do I create within an instant a sense of playfulness? Well, that's a challenge. I think it's probably creating an incongruous joke after that. That's pretty much the easiest bit. Creating the joke is fine. Creating that sense of play or the expectation of play for humor to exist, for humor, for incongruity to take seed and to create humor, I think is the difficult bit, which I'm currently exploring. But fundamentally, I think there's something there. And I think because, and I said to you before, Neil, that we get so many messages. I mean, so much information is coming to our eyeballs because of mobile phones and computers. How do you cut through? And I think we need to cut through human to human. We need to humanize the effect now. Otherwise, it's just going to sound like it's going to be white noise. It's not going to work. And I think, you know, if you're going to do something, you've got to do it so it works and so it's effective. Maybe I'm being a little bit, my industry background means if you're going to do something, you make sure it works. Don't do it just for the sake of doing it, which is some sectors just do it so they tick the box. Do it so it's effective. So if something's going to be effective, you've got to, how do you make that effect best? Is humor an answer? Yes or no? Maybe yes or no. And I think if it is yes, then let's explore how that can be. That can work.
Feels like there's a sort of a natural brand, I guess the word style or tone of voice, that if your brand is already kind of high energy, a little bit playful in itself, that this isn't too far or too many steps to go. It feels like you could actually then sort of develop maybe that storytelling, because I think what you're describing here feels like it's kind of fun, high energy, not crazy and completely wired, but just sort of a high impact, high energy level of storytelling that is fun, yeah, playful, fun. And if your brand's already like that, it feels like that's only just maybe one or two steps of kind of attention and focus to make it happen.
There's plenty of evidence, plenty of literature out there which underpins exactly what you say. Certain industry types lend themselves to humor. You wouldn't be surprised to tell you that selling refrigerators is a bit of a stretch in using humor. However, selling training shoes or a effectively low risk consumer purchases. When I say low risk, you don't drop £10,000 on them or £1,000, but relatively low risk. Say, for example, packets of crisps or a Mars bar or something like that. Anything which is considered low risk, the data and the evidence would suggest is more open, more susceptible to humour. Selling a car with humour, that's a little bit trickier, the evidence suggests. But then again, ask yourself, if you're British Airways, and I say it's a brave move by British Airways, if you're British Airways and you want to cut through, you know your audience is not going to listen to your safety message. You know that. Nobody listens. I mean, give me somebody who actually listens to these safety messages. Nobody does. So if you're at British Airways and you are going to try and cut through with your thousands of customers every day, and you have to make sure that they get this message. And if they don't get it, people could die. I mean, that's a fairly serious risk if British Airways gets this wrong. So if they don't get this message, if they don't know where the exits are, if they don't know where the life jackets are, if they don't know the process, then they could get it wrong. And that could, you know, they could be opening themselves up to a whole, you know, body of risk in terms of legal risk and the environment, safety and health and safety and all the rest. They took a brave decision to say that we're going to use humor in this messaging effect, and they've been copied. I think New Zealand Air have used humor. They've played on the Lord of the Rings, because they now realize that they get cut through, whereas before in your standard message, people just didn't get it, and so they decided to use that. Now that to me wouldn't seem like a natural home for humor. It wouldn't seem like that. It doesn't seem that you could use humour in a fairly serious, risky environment like a health and safety message. Because if you get that wrong, British Airways are on the hook for some serious risk, I think. And so that was something. How can they get away with that? What was about that scenario? And can that be replicated across other brands? And that's something which I'm very, very interested to explore as well. But again, I'm going to temper this by saying, as I said before, I instinctively don't think you can sell funeral homes by using humour. But I could be wrong. I don't know. There is evidence out there that people are selling life insurance. They're selling home insurance through humour. It's really odd. How is that serious message now being communicated? Very effectively, you should say. The data, the analytics behind it suggest that that's a really effective message. Their sales, the metrics after that, this is a company out in America that used humor in their life assurance products. Really effective. I'm fascinated by that and see where we can humanize the message. I mean, your journey, as you described in the early days of law websites and all the rest, you know, the grand pillared doors of august legal offices, maybe that's what the officers, the people in charge, believe that their audiences wanted. Maybe the audiences wanted to see the real people and get a feel, a human feel for the people behind those doors. And I think that's been, and that's evidence. Now, it's inconceivable in this day and age that you would be so inhumane as just to put non-people on websites. I mean, you're always trying to tell about the team because it's human. It connects through it. Can you use humor as well? I don't know. I'm trying to understand that.
Is it back to this word trust? I mean, I keep hearing this word at the back of my mind as you're talking, because it feels to me like there's a little theme here that's kind of running through all of this. No matter whether you want to try this out, no matter whether, you know, your competitors are doing this, or you think, oh, actually, we could be playful, a little bit more playful in some of our campaigns. It might not be something that is right across the whole brand messaging or every communication we do, but maybe in this little, I don't know, this coming Christmas or something, you decide, right, we're going to do a little Christmas campaign. Is it, do you think, that the key theme here is that you can almost kind of get away with it? I'll use that phrase advisedly, but get away with it if you have already established trust in the minds of your both prospects or existing customers? Because it feels like that's a theme that kind of runs through all of this.
I think you've hit the nail. That's a really good nail. Head been hit there. You know, I think fundamentally, how do you develop trust in the eyes of your customers? I mean, if you generally trust people more if you like them. I mean, it's common sense, really. If you like somebody, you're going to tend, it's not a big jump to trust them. If you like them, not necessarily if you like them, you do trust them. I don't trust Boris Johnson as far as I could throw him, but I quite like him. I go for a pint with him. Would I leave him alone with my partner for more than 5 minutes? Not a chance. But it's certainly on the way, it's certainly the route towards trust is to like somebody. And how do you like somebody? And if you can engage with them, if you can emote with them, if you can get on with them, if you can help that with a degree of humor, I think you're on the road towards trust. And I think that's in any commercial engagement setting. If you're going to buy something from somebody, you've got to trust them, full stop. And I think, how do you move towards that point of trust? Being likable, being engaging, being human, being affable. How do you get to that particular stage? Well, is humor, can humor be a play? Now, if I was, you know, a policeman, I wouldn't necessarily want a sense of humor out of my policeman, but I'd certainly want a sense of trust. The two don't necessarily, as I say, gaining trust doesn't necessarily come through sense of humor, but I think it helps in a lot of instances. And I'm really keen to explore that. But I think you're absolutely, I've hit the nail on the head. Trust is where you want to be. How do you get to that? That's that position where you can trust this body, this organization, this individual. I think humor can be an element of that.
I'm enjoying the way that you're defining this word humor, because I think before we kind of really started doing deeper dives into this in this conversation, I guess I was thinking that humor in the way that I was just, I guess, subconsciously defining it was very much about almost kind of to the point of joke telling or being a comedian with a small c here. And that's not really what we're talking about. I think if you ask the average person on the street, you know, just literally walk up to them and say, okay, tell me what you mean by humor, they'd probably say, well, it is a joke, or it's this particular comedian who's my favorite one or whatever. But that isn't actually what we're defining here, is it? This is about intimacy of communication through a lightness of storytelling, really. This is kind of a very different sort of thing, isn't it?
I agree. And I think storytelling is important. I'm trying to give an analogy to what you've just said there, Neil. It's like, I'm not sure if this is all together. Maybe you can edit this bit out because it might not work. But it's like saying, define to me food. Well, it's such a broad thing. Define to me humor. It is. Jokes and storytelling is an element of that. But it's vast, and it's... You know, we're how many people? 7 billion people on the planet. There's probably 7 billion people who've got different types of humor. But there are set types of humor which seem to work more effectively. And if you mine that scene, then you can be You can tell more jokes, so you can be more humorous to more people. I think humor is not restricted to just jokes and storytelling. I think it's an approach which, as I say, fundamentally has a degree of playfulness, expectation of playfulness from the position of the audience, and also incongruity, which comes down the pipeline. So when you say something ironic, it's not what you expect, but it's I had a really good definition of irony once, and I'm going to bugger it up, but basically it's the literal meaning is counterpointed by counterpointed by the actual meaning. So that's unusual. That's incongruous. And I think a man walking down the street slips on a banana. That's not what you expect. That's incongruous to what your expectation. That in of itself, that scenario of a man walking down the street slipping on banana, would not be humorous if there wasn't an expectation of play. If you weren't from the audience, it's tragic. It's mean. It's quite nasty seeing somebody fall on a banana and hurt themselves. But if it's from the position of a clown, instinctively you see the position, there's a guy, he's going to make me laugh, and he slips. There you go. There's humor. Playfulness combined with incongruity, I think, are the fundamental elements. Not the only elements, obviously. There are many, 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 many more, and there's a whole industry out there who make a lot of, you know, a huge industry of humor. I'm saying, until I'm contradicted, that for humor to take place, there has to be those two elements, and I can't, until somebody contradicts me, that's my hypothesis. But within the commercial setting, coming back to my research, within the commercial setting, I'm interested in to see how that could be best used to an effect for a firm, I think, to better improve their messaging to their audience. And I'm saying probably in certain cases, I gave the example of funeral directors or funeral homes, pharmaceutical, that's not going to happen. Probably, because I don't think there's instinctively a sense of play there. So I don't think necessarily you're going to win or you're going to be able to be effective in terms of humor in those settings, because I'm not sure if common sense would lend itself to a degree of playfulness. I don't think that would work in humor in funeral homes. I don't. It's more the emotion that comes to me there is more of is tragedy. But anyway, I don't want to jump. I can go down that rabbit hole. But I think that to my mind is, and I think this, that to my mind, I think is where I'm trying to explore.
And without, I guess, the alienation that I think a lot of people would either assume could potentially happen, you might, by using humour in whatever guise, you know, you as a particular business decide to do it, I guess the fear or the challenge prior to doing that could be, but what happens if we alienate? And I think you kind of used a very useful phrase there that I'd just like to remind people of when, if they're making their decision whether to step forward into this brave new world, is target audience. Mm-hmm. I think if you know your target audience, as you've just described it there, David, I think then there is probably less of a risk in alienation, because you actually know what they're like. You've listened to them, you've been face to face with them, you've kind of talked to them in either a digital sense or a real world sense. So you kind of know what probably would on average be acceptable to them. If you've done a persona profiling exercise, you'll know their kind of lifestyle and what they're used to and probably their values and expectations. So there is some kind of level of you know, sort of safeguarding here, isn't there? As if you think about the target audience and then you don't go and tell any sort of crass joke or something that you know would be consciously inappropriate, I think you can almost sort of, yeah, sort of future-proof yourself here just by maybe just taking those first gentle steps of using the playfulness, incongruity, and so on, just actually just try and play with, yeah, kind of a safer kind of option, knowing the audience, rather than saying, hey, we're going to just suddenly rebrand ourselves this crazy, wacky, humorous, funny, clown-like brand. I mean, that isn't clearly going to work.
I would never, for the sake of it, I would never suggest, I mean, that would be the actions of a very irresponsible marketing manager to decide to do that. I think the purpose is to see, to question, could it be used? Question mark. And again, if you say yes to that, then great, then let's explore that more in an evolving manner. You don't want to reinvent something. Again, drawing parallels with Liz Truss and her travails over the last month or so, she tried to basically completely change the way we approach taxation, for example, in this country. I mean, she decided to take money away from the average man in the street, woman in the street, and give it to the rich. Seems feudalistic in its approach, in my opinion. But that was what she believed was going to make Britain a faster growing economy. Fair enough. That was very, very fast, very, very dramatic. I wouldn't suggest that at all. I question knowing your audience. Is humour potentially, to your, using common sense, could it be appropriate? Question mark. Yes, no. And if the answer is no, fine. We move on down the road. But if the answer is potentially yes, then let's explore that. Because humour lends itself to likability. Likeability lends itself to trust. Trust lends itself to better commercial engagement for your firm. And I think it's something which I'm trying to explore as has to, how can that be better used? Well, actually, two questions. Can it be used in this context within the university student admission setting? And then B, how you can best do that. And I think, you know, so it is a journey, and I think it's an important journey. I think it's something which you've explained a sort of progression in terms of the communication effect through the internet and legal firms. They had a very safe, solid approach, the August, and then they've decided to open that up. Why have they decided to open that up? Make, you know, partner profiles. Why have they put pictures of people on their website? Because it makes people like them. It makes people trust them. If they can see their face and they can see their hobbies and their interests, people like people that they can gain. But it lends itself to likability, and it lends itself to it, which in turn lends itself to the journey of gaining trust. And I think that's something which is, you said it yourself, which is consistent with, if you want to cut through, if you want to engage, that's how you have to emote, you have to get on with people's human side, human to human, as you said.
And I'm guessing as well there are specific channels, if anybody listening to this decides, you know, actually we want to have a little play with this, we want to be playful, we want to start storytelling and just experiment a little bit. I mean, would you advocate maybe ring fencing, I think the technical term is sandboxing, maybe at one particular channel and just exploring it? I mean, the obvious one would be TikTok, for example. Create a TikTok channel, you know, encourage a few of your target audience there, and have some fun with maybe a little short kind of humor campaign, because then you're not necessarily then impacting on the, it was obviously what you don't want to do is cannibalize all of your business and suddenly it's like, oh, well, they're not a serious business anymore. And then you're gone. Yeah. Ring fencing something that's safer probably makes sense, doesn't it, at this early
stage? I mean, TikTok is a classic case. And I should say, having a TikTok, I re-watch TikTok, as most people do these days. And the things which I are really interested in are those messages which are, you know, probably emotive, but certainly humorous in their nature. That keeps me online far more than, you know, somebody kind of shouting or... And I think that's certainly helped. And I think the way of managing that risk of your, because you can't mess around with the brand, but you can manage it and you can trial it out. You can sandbox it, if you will, and see if it works. I think if you can start pushing that boundary with a degree of humor and see if it works. If it doesn't work, fine. But as part of the iterative development process, yeah, I think that's a really good approach, is just to use a relatively safe environment, like TikTok, and just practice with it and see if it works and see if people engage. And if you do get engagement through humor, there's all the plus side, but there's the risk of if damaging your brand is minimized. So the downside is minimized, but the upside is potentially far more attractive. So yeah, I think that's a really good approach.
Brilliant. I would love if we could call this particular episode part one. Would you come back and share when the time is right, share your results with us? Because I think this would be a lovely follow-up if we could do a part two.
My PhD ethics sits with some very unhumorous people in an office with ethics on their door, and they're making sure that I'm not doing anything unethical, which will have a detrimental effect on the university's reputation for doing ethical research. I expect that to be pretty much given the okay this week, and then I'll start the process of making my two messages and then putting them out. And hopefully by spring next year, I will be in a position to have some preliminary results. I will be, as I say, presenting them to a conference, the ISHS conference in Boston next year. I'll be giving, and then once you've got your data, it's just a case of testing your data, seeing if your hypothesis stack up, if they don't stack up, and then exploring that. That's some. So yeah, I'll be happy to come back, subject to me having data in springtime next year.
Wonderful. I don't want to gazump the Boston conference, so maybe just after that, because whilst I'd love to steal their thunder and
have a sense of humor about it
here first, but that would be a laugh, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but honestly, you know, I don't see them having too much of an issue with that. They're quite good nature. They're very funny people, actually. Well, actually, are they? I mean, I went to their conference last year, and some of them were really pointy-headed, and they're right, you know, really nerdy. But some of them are quite funny. I didn't laugh a lot, surprisingly, at the conference. I thought I might do, but I didn't. It was
They're clearly trying to build trust with you, aren't they? Clearly at this stage. Maybe that comes next year.
Maybe it does.
Brilliant. So, David McGee, thank you so much for coming along to this episode. It's been fascinating little exploration into the first steps. This is part one of Humour in Marketing. Watch out now for part two coming soon in 2023.
Okay. Thank you.